Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 115, episode 115 of the Flux Capacitor. This is another stripped down episode, so no cold open, just a short intro and close so we can get it up online and do so quickly. This will, I hope, prove to be timely because we're talking about the Canadian-US electricity relationship. I have for months now been promising an episode about the Canada-US electricity trade relationship once we got some clarity about the tariff actions by the administration in Washington. But, you know, we can only wait so long for that. So we're going to do a check-in today. And today is June 24th, 2025. On the pod today is our man in D.C., Andrew Shaw. Andrew is a partner with the firm Bracewell, and he is Electricity Canada's principal consultant in Washington. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Well, great to be here, Francis. Thanks for the invitation and look forward to the conversation.
And it's a conversation that, you know, we've been talking about scheduling. And as I said a moment ago, you know, it was all about, hey, let's talk when we have some greater clarity. You know, we've been saying that for several months now. And then we finally did schedule it and say, hey, let's just, you know, agree on a date and time. And we've agreed on a date and time. And here we are. You're in Washington, D.C. I'm in an airport lounge in St. John's, Newfoundland. But since we actually scheduled this, a lot has happened, even in that short period of time. A war has broken out between Israel and Iran. The United States has bombed Iran. And now the President Trump has declared that there's a ceasefire. So there is no rest at all on any of these broad issues. But I thought maybe let's step back from all of that noise. And let's talk about the Canada-US relationship through that sort of Canadian lens and the Canadian electricity lens. And maybe as a reminder for the listener, let's step back to before 2025. And, you know, what was that relationship like? Because we've been working together for, it's got to be a decade now. And, you know, we've been talking Canada-US trade, and it had been stable really up until earlier this year. How would you describe that relationship?
Well, I'd say overall, pre-2025, I think the relationship, by and large, the broader relationship between the U.S. and Canada was incredibly positive. That's not to say that there weren't challenges and obstacles and differences of opinion between the two countries. You think about two longstanding trade disputes, dairy and softwood lumber. Those have persisted across Republican and Democratic administrations. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it's fair to say what we've seen, you know, post 2025, at least in the initial couple months of President Trump's administration, is an amplification of the tensions between the mm-hmm. two countries. Not necessarily, again, new issues. Some of them are new, but there has been at least with the previous prime minister, a real focus on some of these simmering trade issues. I think electricity, of course, was part of that early discord between the Trump administration, the president, mm-hmm. and the Canadian government. But, you know, by and large, I think Canadian electricity, both prior to January 20th, when President Trump took office, and subsequent to that, remains an important piece of the relationship that doesn't get as much attention as it probably should, mm-hmm. but is viewed as a positive in being able to meet growing demand, maintain grid reliability, and keep rates affordable. There's, as with previous administrations, there's always a need when you have new policymakers come into office, new members of Congress, new folks in the NGO and think tank community to educate, make sure that they are up to speed on the state of the relationship, the electricity relationship, and explore where there's opportunities for consensus and progress.
Yeah. So since the beginning of 2025, things have been different. You know, one of them is this focus on tariffs. We've seen a broad range of different tariffs and different different approaches to tariffs, different authorities that have been used. What's from from your perspective, what do you think is really driving this interest in tariffs by the administration? Because there's been lots of speculation. Is this an opportunity to address the budget shortfall? Is this about onshoring manufacturing? There's a lot of the potential drivers for this, or is it some kind of combination of all of those? I know it's purely speculative, but if you were to speculate on what the principal drivers are, because this is different than the first Trump administration, what do you think those drivers are, and how are they different now than they were, 6 years ago?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think one issue that President Trump has been consistent on, throughout his time in public life, and frankly dating back to the 1980s, is an interest and arguably a fascination with trade imbalances and using tariffs to try to correct those trade imbalances. You know, we saw that. We did see that in his first administration, particularly in the context of steel and aluminum tariffs, which have again resurfaced and have increased over the last several months. What we did see in his first administration was more of a balance, perhaps between, those that want to push a more aggressive trade policy and those that have maybe a more traditional Republican approach to trade and the bilateral relationship with Canada. So I think at top, President Trump, there it's no secret. He likes tariffs. He wants to address trade imbalances. But I think it's also true, just like President Biden, just like President Obama, President Trump has a deep desire to reshore manufacturing back here in the US. Whether his trade and tariff policy will achieve that or not, I think, of course, remains to be seen. But you look at his political coalition that he's built now since 2016, and there is deep support for him among blue-collar workers in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, places that are swing states and that are critical to his ability to get to 270 electoral votes, i.e., to become president. Ohio, in fact, in the time that President Trump has been either a presidential candidate or president, has now become a deeply red state, which is a significant shift over where the state has been historically. So I think the pledges that candidate Trump made both in 2016 and then in 2020 and 2024 are important to him and trying to use tariffs as a tool to rebuild some of these manufacturing towns and communities in the Rust Belt, I think is an important political and economic priority for him. I think it's also worth noting that tariffs are something, though under congressional authority pursuant to the US Constitution, Congress has afforded the executive branch a fair amount of discretion in using different authorities to promulgate tariffs. And President Trump is, whether folks like it or not, he is very aggressive in using his executive authority to be able to bypass Congress and achieve some of his political and economic goals. So I think the fact that he is at least able to use that, and we see courts responding to whether they think he's exceeding his authority in some of these more expansive tariffs that he's issued. But I think he enjoys the fact that he can use this authority and not necessarily wait around for Congress. You mentioned deficit reduction. I think that's part of it. Certainly, we're having a debate right now in the context of budget reconciliation legislation, a process under which Republicans in Congress are looking to extend pretty expensive tax cuts and pursue other goals. Tariffs, I think, broadly speaking, are used by the administration to be sold as a means to raise revenue. But to me, that's kind of second tier to some of the other priorities and some of the other benefits that this president and this administration looks at in implementing tariffs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to circle back on a couple of things that you mentioned there. But before that, I did want to pause and ask you and ask everybody who comes on the podcast about your journey. And I always make the joke every time. Andrew, when you were a kid in the playground, did you always dream of being a lobbyist? Was this the path that you thought you'd take? And what was the path that led you to become a partner now at Bracewell?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I grew up in the Midwest, in Kansas City, and I was always interested in politics and history, even as a young kid. I was reading, and this is probably kind of embarrassing to say, but reading Margaret Truman novels about, based here in DC, and, watching the news and when I was a kid, in addition to doing other things. I don't want to paint too dire of a picture of my childhood, but I was always interested in government and politics and public policy. I came out began my career after college working for a member of Congress from the Midwest, from the Kansas City area, and then came out to Washington, D.C. to work with them. We're talking about trade. I think it's interesting to note that he was a free trade Democrat. That this was a time where Congress was looking and approving free trade agreements. But some of the same tensions were there. There were concerns about the growing power of China. There were concerns about some of the trade policy, some of the impacts on manufacturing communities. But I worked for him doing energy, environmental, public land issues, and then spent some time at EPA clerking both here in Washington, D.C., and then in one of the regional offices. And then went to the private side. I say this and people, I think, laugh and think I'm being facetious, but I never wanted to work in a law firm, never wanted to work in private practice, but had an opportunity to do that. And I thoroughly enjoyed it over the last 15, 16 years, and had the opportunity to work on U.S.-Canada issues in the context of the energy sector. And it's been a fascinating time. A lot has changed, and in some ways, a lot hasn't changed in that space. But every day is different. It gives me the opportunity to work with a lot of companies and a lot of organizations doing a lot of good, including Electricity Canada.
Interesting. So one of the things that you noted earlier, and I think it's worth sort of foot stomping, and that is, protectionism is not something that is specific to the Trump administration or the Republican Party. I mean, you noted that under the Democrats, while they weren't necessarily using the tariff instruments, there was a very strong protectionist streak as well, the Buy American. This is more of a trend as opposed to something that is specific to a political side of a side of the political spectrum, right?
Completely. In fact, Democrats historically have been more protectionist, and arguably, certainly parts of their party have been anti-free trade. So that has been a stronger constituency historically in the Democratic side. Obviously, you had administrations like President Clinton, who pretty forcefully advocated for free trade, including for the enactment of NAFTA, and that shifted the paradigm. President Obama did pursue trade agreements, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that ultimately did not the U.S. did not participate in. But I think what we've seen, post President Trump's kind of arrival in the political scene in 2015, is Democrats move back to maybe a more protectionist view and more protectionist stance on trade. And some of that, I think, they're looking at how can they reclaim the blue collar working class vote and the Rust Belt. But you saw in the Biden administration, no new free trade agreements, which I think is the first time in many, many decades that a administration actually did not approve or secure any new free trade agreements. And I think if you look at where the energy is in the Democratic Party right now, it's probably on the left where there's more skepticism for free trade and trade in general than more of the center left of the Democratic Party.
Wow. Yeah. No, I hadn't, that hadn't occurred to me, but yeah, that's interesting. That throughout their entire administration, we didn't see one of those. One of the other things you mentioned, was, authorities and where these tariffs come from. I think I noted to you earlier that, before we got onto this call, that, if somebody looking at this from the outside goes and looks on Wikipedia and tries to figure out, who does what and where do tariffs come from, they would see that, as you noted, this is a congressional power. But, as we've been talking about this, you and I, for several months, each time there's another either a tariff action or, the suggestion of a new tariff action, you're always telling me, this one is a Section 301 action, and this one's a Section 222 action, and this one is an IEEPA action. So there's a broad range of different instruments, it sounds like, that the president is able to lean upon that presumably give him authority that usually rests with Congress. Is that how this is working? And also some of these laws are from the 70s and the 60s. And I think like one of the ones that didn't move forward was back like in 100 years ago with Smoot-Hawley, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And there are what we've seen, and we've seen this in other on other issues too. Certainly, energy and environmental issues come front of mind. But we've seen Congress delegate to the executive branch authority to on trade issues to take a variety of actions. Some of what we have seen have been more traditional kind of trade actions where there's a fair amount of precedent and previous examples of other, both during President Trump's first administration and other administrations using statutes that Congress has enacted that give the executive branch authority. Section 232 is one of those of the Trade Expansion Act. That gives the administration, after a finding that imports impair national security, gives them the authority to impose trade actions, including tariffs, on certain imports. And we've seen that in the context of steel, aluminum, autos. 301 is more looking at unfair trade practices. That's been relevant in the renewable sector, both from Trump 1 through the Biden administration, actually dating back to the Obama administration, where there were tariffs on solar modules, solar cells coming from China. But what has been interesting, and I think has been of a significant focus, obviously, in the bilateral relationship, has been the Trump administration using IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, to promulgate these economy-wide tariffs since he took office. IEEPA historically has been a statute that the president has used to impose sanctions on countries for a variety of actions that they have undertaken. It's never been used in this context to impose economy-wide tariffs. Of course, those that have been closely following the IEEPA tariffs, they've been challenged in court. President Trump did pause the IEEPA tariffs for USMCA compliant goods. And so those have been kind of in limbo. But the IEEPA tariffs have been challenged in court, and two different courts have found that the president exceeded his authority in implementing them. Those cases are in appeal. My guess is that they will eventually make it to the Supreme Court at some point. But the appellate courts have allowed the tariffs to remain in place, while they consider the appeals. So there's more to come in that space. But I think to your original question, there are established statutes, but this administration, like they're doing in a lot of places, are pushing the boundaries, moving aggressively, using statutes that weren't necessarily thought of to give the executive branch more authority in the trade space.
So let's to touch on some of the administration's priorities with respect to electricity and what that may do to trade. So we've seen policies that favor certain types of generation, and we've seen policies that are suppressing other types of generation. So a reduced emphasis on renewables and more of an emphasis on some traditional and fossil fuel-based electricity generation. Is this likely to change what the supply and demand picture would look like with respect to the Canadian-US trade in electricity? Is there going to be more or less trade driven by these policies with respect to how electricity is produced now in the United States and will be produced at least in the years ahead?
Well, it's a great question, and I do think there's an interest among officials in the government in trying to understand, where demand is going, both in the U.S. and in Canada. We all see the same reports about skyrocketing demand due to hyperscale data centers and AI, obviously industrial reshoring. Some electrification of other sectors of the economy are also going to contribute to more demand for electricity. So I think there is an interest in understanding, where load forecasts are in Canada, what available supplies might be out there for the U.S. To be able to access in the future. Clearly, we've seen by this administration a very significant effort to maintain baseload resources. We've seen a couple Section 202C orders, which are must-run orders, to keep some fossil plants online that were slated to close. I think when it comes to Canada, in addition to understanding kind of where demand is going, both here in the U.S. and in Canada, I do think that there remains an interest in trying to make it easier to facilitate trade back and forth between the two countries, which I recognize is a little bit in contrast to the broader broader dynamic right now on trade. But if you peel back the onion and look at what this administration is doing specifically on electricity, the impacts, if implemented, could make it easier to enhance the trade between the two countries. And I take two examples. You know, one, the Department of Energy has proposed trying to essentially repeal the presidential permit processes for electric transmission lines between the two countries. And you've seen some efforts supported by this administration in Congress that would statutorily make that process more or less maybe not a rubber stamp, but make it seamless in expediting the permitting and consideration of such lines, along with other cross-border energy infrastructure like oil pipelines and natural gas pipelines. We've also seen from this administration, also the Department of Energy, and a draft rule that would streamline the application process for U.S. companies to export electricity to Canada and Mexico. So again, it suggests to me that, you know, when you kind of peel back the onion, you look at what this administration is actually doing on U.S. Canadian electricity issues or issues that impact the electricity relationship, there seems to be a desire at least explore deepening trade. The last thing I'll say is it is clear that this administration has favored resources and disfavored resources. The previous administration did too. So it they're just different. But hydropower, which is obviously a significant and important part of your electricity mix and an important part of the imports that the U.S. brings in, is a resource that the U.S. And this administration views quite favorably. I think they like the fact that it is a baseload, reliable resource. And so I think that's another aspect, you know, going forward that will be important in realizing the potential of the U.S. Canadian electricity relationship.
Right. We can't chat today without mentioning the one big beautiful bill, and where it happens to be at right now. So it is through the House. It's now in front of the Senate committee, I believe. But from a Canadian perspective and a Canadian electricity perspective, are there things that we should be keeping our eye on in Canada? We'd call that a piece of omnibus legislation. It's a big bill, is an omnibus bill. But are there things that we should be really keeping a close eye on that might impact our relationship?
Yeah, there are. And just to take a quick step back as to where it is and what we can expect. The full Senate is hoping to vote on the package at some point in the next couple of days. My guess is we probably won't get there this week, but we could potentially see action over the weekend or more likely into next week. And again, this could bleed further into July. The president had initially set a goal of Congress sending him the legislation by the July 4th deadline. Absent some big breakthrough, I don't see that happening because the House will have to agree to whatever the Senate does, or they'll have to ping pong back and forth different versions of the bill. I think Congress will get there. It's just a matter of timing. As to what should be on the radar screen for folks in the Canadian electricity sector, I think arguably the provision that's getting the most attention as far as a trade measure in there is this so-called revenge tax. It's also in Section 8899, which is the part of that of the is the provision is the number of the provision in the House bill. This provision would impose a tax on foreign companies through their U.S. subsidiaries for countries that have discriminatory tax or non-tax measures impacting U.S. companies. In the Canadian context, I think there is rightfully a concern that Canada's digital services tax would be viewed as discriminatory against U.S. tech companies and could be used as a basis to impose this revenge tax on Canadian companies operating through subsidiaries in the U.S. The House and Senate have different versions of this so-called revenge tax. The Senate one is a little bit less draconian. I think it will remain in any final compromise. It raises a fair amount of money, which they need because they're trying to extend tax cuts and offset at least partially the cost. But I think it gives, hopefully there will be a pause in implementation and give this administration here in Washington an opportunity to address some of these issues through their ongoing bilateral discussions. The other provisions, in the electricity space that are getting a lot of attention are the phase down of various IRA clean electricity tax incentives. And I know a lot of your members are have assets that they own and operate and/or are developing here in the States. But I think what we're likely to see, and the final details remain unclear, is a significant paring down of the investment tax credit and production tax credit for wind and solar. Other non-emitting baseload resources like nuclear, geothermal, and hydropower are likely to be treated much, much better. Exactly when those phase down and what the value of that phase down looks like continues to be debated between Republicans on the Hill. And then other things that impact the sector more broadly, like the EV tax credits and the hydrogen production tax credits. Those things are both the House and Senate versions would virtually cut those credits off at the end of the year or shortly after the passage of this bill. Pretty significant change from where we were at in 2022 after the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act that established or extended and expanded a lot of these clean energy tax incentives.
Mm-hmm. Plenty to keep our eye on as we head between now and July 4th.
Well, I think most in the U.S. are hoping that we don't see a deal on July 2nd or July 3rd. Mm-hmm. We'd like to enjoy a little bit of a holiday, but we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. Andrew, one thing that I ask everybody that comes on the podcast is for a book recommendation. And we assemble them all on our reading list, our Flux Capacitor Book Club reading list. And so what book would you have us add to our reading list?
Well, at the outset, you talked about my journey to get here, and I mentioned I grew up in Kansas. So my book recommendation is a little bit dated in the sense it's been out there for 20 plus years, but I feel like the analysis is still very on point. And the book is What's the Matter with Kansas by Thomas Frank, who is a grew up in the same general area that I grew up in, and was a columnist for the New York Times and a prolific thought leader and author. But, you know, he looks at the impact of culture as being the driving force in U.S. politics. Not, you know, whereas economic issues, and this was, mind you, in the early 2000s, had receded. And in many ways, I think his analysis of U.S. politics and where things are at remains pretty prescient.
Wow. Okay. Well, we will add that to our list. And Andrew, I want to thank you for joining the podcast. I really appreciated the opportunity to catch up.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Also enjoyed the conversation.
Great. So for those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen. And let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me on Instagram as TheBradBradley, on Blue Sky as @FrancisBradley, on LinkedIn and through our website at electricity.ca. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page, this being episode 115. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including today's recommendation, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America by Thomas Frank. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.